This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDEP. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for joining us. No secret that we don't really like each other much in this nation right now. That's at least what we see in the headlines and what we feel, I think, in spaces like social media. But the differences for sure seem to be running much deeper these days. We don't listen to each other because we don't interact, and we don't interact because we're really different. We live in different places. We think about different things, talk about different things. Liberals are more likely to live in cities, to be agnostic or atheist, and have non-white friends. Conservatives are pretty much the opposite. They are more Christian, more rural, less likely to have friends that don't resemble them. It really does feel sometimes as though we're living in two countries. So how real is that? We know these divisions and factions have caused real problems in our politics and in our culture, but how far does the division really go? We know that countries can break apart. They can cease to exist as one, and that almost happened in this nation, of course, many years ago during the Civil War. But could something like that happen again? And if it were to, how would we know it was going to happen? What are the warning signs? What was the meaning, for instance, of the January 6th insurrection last year? Or how about the storming of Michigan's Capitol and the attempted kidnapping of Governor Gretchen Whitmer? Are these signs that we are closer to a split as Americans and maybe a war over that split? Barbara Walter is someone who has thought a lot about these questions. She's a professor at the University of California, San Diego, and has studied civil wars in many other countries around the world. She recently turned her attention to the United States, as she believes our country is increasingly likely to be headed in that direction. Professor Walter has written all about this in her new book, How Civil Wars Start. Professor Walter, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So your book starts with the plot to kidnap our governor here in the state of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer. So
yes.
Let's talk about why you start a book about our political divisions with our own state here and not maybe with the January 6th insurrection.
Well, I start the book with that because it's very indicative of the very, very early stages of insurgency. The CIA actually has a manual called The Guide to Insurgency, which they put together in order to try to predict or try to anticipate what countries are likely descending into that type of violence. And there's three stages. There's the pre-insurgency stage, the incipient insurgency stage, and the full insurgency stage. And the incipient insurgency stage is when you have these isolated acts of violence. And the what's dangerous about that stage is usually the citizens who are experiencing this violence or the government, they don't connect the dots. They see these as isolated incidents. They see these as the result of a crazy individual or a small group of individuals who are really not a threat and certainly not part of a larger movement. And so they tend to be either downplayed or ignored. And I think that's what we've been seeing in this country. And the Michigan plot against the governor, in my opinion, is one of those events.
And so I get all of that, and I can't argue with any of it, to be honest. I think these signs are very disturbing, and they are also very clear. But I guess there's a part of me that says times are so different than they were in the 1850s or 1840s in the run-up to the Civil War that we did have. And there are so many things that would argue against not a split of the nation, which I think we are really kind of living in now. I mean, if you live in New York or California or Connecticut, you're not living really in the same country in many ways as somebody who lives in Mississippi or Oklahoma. But this idea that it would come to a conflict, right? The idea that there might be a shooting war about all of this. I don't know. Somehow, I don't fully believe that would happen. In large part because I think we're more okay with the idea that we're in different spaces at this point. And I don't know that either side wants to force the other side to live the way that they do, so much as they just don't want to live the way that the other side is living. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yes, in some ways, you're absolutely correct. I think one of the reasons why it's hard for many Americans to even think that a second civil war is possible is because they're thinking of the 1860s version of a civil war. They're thinking about two large armies meeting each other on a battlefield in uniforms with a large segment of the country unified against the Union, wanting to secede. And that was a 19th century type of civil war. The types of civil wars that tend to happen today, the 21st century civil wars, are very different. And they're especially different when they're fought against a powerful country with a very powerful military. If you look back into the at 1860, the U.S. military was not very strong. Sure. And the Confederacy was actually quite strong. The Confederate states had hundreds of small militias that already existed long before, in the decades before the Civil War, and they were created in order to put down slave uprisings. So when the South decided it was going to secede, all it had to do was take these militias, bring them together, and they had a standing army. At the same time, the federal government had about 16,000 soldiers. That's it. And those 16,000 soldiers were, for the most part, stationed out west to put down Indian uprisings. So if you're the South and you want to secede and you want to go to war against the federal government in 1860s, it was not a crazy idea. It would be a completely crazy idea to try to do that today when we have almost over 2 million soldiers under arms. And so what happens in the 21st century is groups that are angry at a government, groups that want to pursue their own policies and kind of be free of what they see as often government overreach, they pursue insurgencies. They form militias or they form paramilitary groups. They're very decentralized. They tend to operate in the shadows. They don't want to engage soldiers in the military. And instead, they pursue unconventional tactics like guerrilla warfare and terrorism, and they tend to target civilians. Average citizens, in this case, it would be, for example, you see the targeting of synagogues, you see the targeting of Black churches, you see the targeting of opposition leaders or judges or doctors who are performing abortions. That's the 21st century type of civil war that we would see here in the United States if it were to occur.
And how would that change the way that we're living right now, for instance? I mean, as you point out in the book, we're seeing people do things that are quite extraordinary in the context of U.S. history, at least. And they are threatening civilians and in some cases, you know, government officials. What would change, or how do we know things were changing to the state of an actual violent cleave of the nation?
Yeah. So I think it would change. Initially, it would change the most at the state level. And you're already, already starting to see this happen, where state legislatures are increasingly pursuing policies, so especially social policies, that are much more conservative than the median voter in those states. What you're seeing is the more extreme elements of a party are being really savvy. They're playing a very long game of trying to capture state legislatures and then pushing through their policies that way. How do I want to put this? And so they're getting at the state level what they can't get at the federal level. The even more extreme elements, if you want to be a little bit dystopic about this, if you think about the far right here in this country, about 65% of far right groups are white supremacist groups. About 29% are anti-federal government groups. The white supremacists believe that the United States is a white Christian nation, and they believe that it's their right to fight to keep the United States a white Christian nation. That's going to be very difficult to do at the national level, but in some states like Michigan, they might be able to accomplish it. And because Michigan, for example, is a state where you have this large urban-rural divide, where essentially the rural places in Michigan are heavily white. The urban areas are heavily non-white. If you're a white supremacist in Michigan and you believe that government should be run by whites and Christians, and you can somehow convince African Americans, Muslims, other non-white people who live in places like Detroit or Grand Rapids or Flint to leave the state, then essentially you can create the white ethno-national state that you always wanted.
And if you do that, does that mean that we are not one country anymore? Does that mean that essentially we're living in maybe multiple countries all at the same time?
That's a really great question. It means that we're becoming less united, right? And again, we're the United States of America. It means it is getting to the core identity of this country. And in fact, that's what the battle is about. White supremacists and extremists on the far right are in a battle for what they see is the future identity of this country. Is it going to be, a heterogeneous, multi-ethnic, multi-religious, global-oriented country? Or is it going to remain what they believe are its true roots, which is white and Christian and conservative? And they would like to create this in as many parts of the country as they can. And so if that's happening, while at the same time on the coasts and in other heavily populated states, the left is becoming increasingly liberal, increasingly global, increasingly educated, you have two very different Americas.
So I guess the other question is, what do you do to reverse this? It does seem that everything that happens right now seems to pour gas on the fire of this divide. And in some cases, it's just things operating the way that they are supposed to, right? A former president keeps boxes of former documents. The DOJ says, we're going to go get them. That doesn't seem on its face terribly controversial, but in the context of everything else, it does become really controversial and people get angrier. So what are we supposed to be doing to push this in another direction?
There's really three things. The first is strengthen our democracy. The federal government has been declining in strength relative to the individual states for decades now. And that has almost accelerated. So we now have a majority on the Supreme Court who believes more strongly in states' rights than in some respects in the power of the federal government. Mm-hmm. And if individual states are allowed to make their own policies and the federal government can't override these policies, even if it deems those policies are unconstitutional, then this division is going to continue, and this these two separate Americas are going to come into being. And then the second thing we can do is, again, it's our parties are heavily divided along race. The Republican mm-hmm. Party is predominantly white and Christian, and the Democratic Party is pretty much everyone else, including sort of the liberal wing of the white population. And that's a problem. You know, if again, America is multi-ethnic, multi-religious, we need our two main parties to be reaching across religious and racial lines. And so that would turn the ship around. And then, you know, people ask me all the time, what's the single easiest thing that we can do to reduce the risk of violence moving forward? And my answer is always the same. It's regulate social media. All of these things have been accelerating since the mid-2000s. The decline of democracy, not just here in the United States, but in liberal democracies around the world, the rise of ethnic nationalism, the rise of far-right nationalist parties, the rise of hate crimes, the rise of militias. This is all running in lockstep with the rise of social media, and more importantly, with the changes that social media companies have made to their recommendation engines. Right. Yeah. The algorithms that Facebook and YouTube and all of these popular sites use are designed to keep people engaged on their phones as long as possible. And they understand,
I'm sorry, experiments, Barbara,
that they've done. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm out of time, but this is such a great conversation and such a wonderful book. I'm really glad that you were able to join us today. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
That's going to do it for us today. We'll be back tomorrow. Hope you will too. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation.